Prices and we're going to be speaking with Mike Schreiner, leader of the Green Party of Ontario. Good afternoon, Mike.
Good afternoon, Kevin. Pleasure to be on.
Or email. Thanks so much for making the time. And for those that are not in our immediate area, we got hit by a snowstorm somehow.
I tell you what, winter came back with a vengeance today. I was just walking along the river in Guelph 2 days ago, and the ducks and geese were making music, and now we have snow on the ground again.
It's a little bit insane. I don't really know what to make of it. But it is what it is, and it's, I guess it's only April 6th today. So thank you very much, Mike, for coming in. It's not yet hit the full news cycle, but we are having elections, provincial elections this year.
Yeah, in about 62 days, but I'm not counting.
Okay. Now, is there an official launch period from the government's perspective or Elections Ontario?
Yeah, so the writ will drop on May 9th, which is a Thursday. It's always a Thursday in Ontario. And then, Wednesday, and then Thursday for election. And then June 7th is the actual election day.
So, in terms of the, because we now have fixed elections, I guess it seems a little different to me, because before there was always the suspense of the government would pick some time.
Right.
And then, as you said, the writ would drop and then everybody would get going. From a practical perspective now, what does that really mean? Like, are we not campaigning until May 9th? You're just out talking to people? Is that...
Well, it is true. So the campaign started earlier now. But okay. You know what? People are sort of campaigning a bit all the time anyway. I think the advantage of a fixed election date is it takes it out of the hands of the government to play political games of when they'll actually drop the writ for an election campaign. Mm-hmm. And as you know, there are more than enough political games happening at Queen's Park. And, you know, as I travel around Ontario, spend a lot of time in my home riding of Guelph, I hear over and over again from people that they are sick and tired of the status quo at Queen's Park, the political games that people play at Queen's Park. And so if we can take one of those chips off the table, which is playing a game with when the actual election day is, mm-hmm. I think that's a good thing for democracy.
For sure. Because it's, I think it also creates, like you said, it's a bit of separation, right, from that decision-making and the party in power, right? So obviously... heck, you're the leader of the Green Party of Ontario. We're going to talk a lot of stuff is going to hit politics one way or the other. But just to step us back for a moment, just tell us a little bit more about yourself, Mike, if you don't mind. Where were you born, and take us from birth to now with as little or as much detail as you'd like.
Sure. Well, first of all, I'm a husband, father. Somebody who grew up on a farm and have been around food and farming all my life. So I'm a big local food advocate. Started my first business 23 years ago in Guelph. And it was one of Ontario's first local organic food distribution businesses, delivering food to people in Guelph and throughout the greater Toronto area. Mm-hmm. And that business is still in business. And, you know, big shout out to my business partner who's taken that business over and really run with it. It's now located in Brampton. It was actually... a few years ago, Small Business of the Year in Brampton.
Oh, wow.
Which is pretty cool. And it's also my business won Citizens Bank of Canada Socially Responsible Business of the Year Award. Mm-hmm. Also Local Food Hero Award. So I'm very proud of that work I've done, and ran a food production business in Guelph as well, and also helped start a number of nonprofits, but in particular an organization called Local Food Plus, mm-hmm. which was all about connecting local food and farmers. And so I think I've taken my passion for, being a farm kid, stewardship of the land and water, and then my background as an entrepreneur, both in the private sector as a small business owner and in the NGO sector as a nonprofit leader, and sort of brought that to politics. And I think part of what inspired me to get involved in politics was sort of one of the things where I've always been interested in politics, but became disillusioned with politics because I didn't feel like it was about putting people first. Mm-hmm, and so I sort of backed away and said, you know, I can make the world a better place as a business person, as a nonprofit leader, as somebody, you know, just raising a family and taking care of my kids and what have you. But, you know, my wife, my kids, my friends, people around me were just like, you know, Mike, you complain about the way politics is done. You have a lot of good ideas and clearly a lot of passion to serve your community, to make the world a better place. Why don't you get involved in politics? And so that inspired me to sort of re-engage. And when I was trying to decide, you know, which political party I wanted to, dedicate my time to, the Green Party just seemed like the one that fit my values the most, because it is a party that really strongly supports small business owners like myself, but also a party that's socially progressive, fiscally responsible, and also, you know, wants to take action in protecting the people and places we love. And, you know, that means protecting farmland and water and green space, and also taking action on the climate crisis.
Right.
And so that's sort of what inspired me to get involved. And I can tell you, Kevin, getting elected as a Green is not the easiest thing I've ever done in my life.
No.
But I have a little saying on my desk that I look at every morning that says, you know, I want to be elected for the right reasons, and not or for the right, for choosing the right road, not for choosing the easy one.
For the expediency of getting That's elected, right. which is I think starting to become on an international scale, questions people are starting to ask about, you know, democracy in general, how we've implemented it in North America in particular. I think in some cases we're starting to see maybe some challenges to the way, to things that we didn't think were an issue. We thought, well, at least that's my view, that it seemed that, well, the nature of democracy, it's messy. Everybody, I think, will agree with, it's not perfect. Nobody always gets everything they want, but there's a balance. There's a power of the people. I mean, you know, not to get into a Greek language lesson, but, you know, democracy is ultimately about representation of the people, for the people, and so on and so forth. And a lot of people might say that's at least a little bit south of us. It's maybe falling, maybe that's getting disjointed. But I want to come back to something you said, Mike, was about choosing the Green Party. So two things. One, you weren't a Green Party supporter from an early age and all of a sudden just decided, okay, I'm going to lead this. It was more a matter of, like you said, when you decided I want to make an impact on a political level, let me see where I could.
That's right.
Where do I line up, really?
And Kevin, I think that's true for most people. I mean, the Green Party is such a new party that, you know, most people grew up as, you know, a family.
Well, true
their
enough,
family
yeah.
voted liberal or conservative.
I was trying to make you sound like a millennial. The Green Party was around when you were a kid. Fair enough.
Though I tell you what, the millennial generation doesn't realize the political power they actually have, just in terms of numbers alone.
Right.
A tremendous amount of political power. So when I talk to millennials all the time, I always say, you know, exercise the power of your demographic to bring about the change that you want. No, for me, it was, you know, I started as a volunteer. I started volunteering with the Green Party and just became more and more active over time. And, you know, thankfully, my predecessor, Frank DeYoung, who led the party for 16 years, really supported me, encouraged me, and at one point said, Mike, you know, I think you should consider running to replace me at some point.
Okay.
And as well as other people as well. And so, you know, it's a responsibility I take seriously. And one of the things I'm really proud of, and you talked about, you know, democracy being about the people. I mean, I think one of the things that sets the Green Party apart is that we're really about people powered change. And we're about doing politics differently in a way that puts people first. And, you know, I think people are tired of, you know, political games at Queen's Park. They're tired of, you know, wealthy donors having a big influence, or lobbyists, corporate insiders, etc. And we're about, you know, what are policies that just make sense, that put people first.
Right.
And so one of my proudest accomplishments as leader of the Green Party of Ontario is we led the charge in 2016 to get big money out of politics.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, obviously the media played a big role in that. I mean, all these cash for access events that the Premier Wynne was doing that, you know, historically had been done by the other two status quo parties at Queen's Park. And so we led the charge on that. And to the credit of the other three parties, they actually listened.
Right.
And so now in Ontario, corporate and union donations are banned. Political donations have dropped significantly from, you know, people being able to donate $33,000 or so a year to now $3,600 a year.
Right, and that's individuals only.
That's individuals only and not, yeah, so corporation unions can no longer donate. I mean, the influence of that money still is flowing in the system because the restrictions just came into effect, you know, a little over a year ago. But I think, you know, that's a significant accomplishment that I really take a lot of pride in, mm-hmm. because it's putting our democracy on a more even playing field and is making our democracy more about people and not big corporations or wealthy insiders. And so, you know, I look at, you know, I'm proud that we accomplished that before having a seat at Queen's Park. And, you know, imagine what we can accomplish when we have a seat at Queen's Park after this next election.
For sure. And in fact, although I don't know the specifics of the legislation, but I do recall at a federal level a few years before that, the same thing happened.
That's right.
And, the numbers were slightly different, but the main piece was there was a cap that was fairly low. I think it was $1,250 or $1,500 per individual. I believe corporations could contribute, but it was also capped at like $1,000 actually, now that I'm...
Yeah, so just to be clear, so the Chrétien government brought in legislation to, you know, ban corporate and union donations and significantly lower donation limits, and the Harper government came afterwards, actually
they
maintained the support. What they reversed was there was public funding of political parties.
Right, okay, that's what I was going to
get
at. Yeah.
And so that's what the Harper government reversed, and I think it's unfortunate, because if we want to get big money out of politics, there still has to be a way to fund political parties to be able to do the work they do. Mm-hmm. And I would much rather have it come from a democratic standpoint where your vote directs donations instead of people with deep pockets directing donations and influencing the system that way. And so I'm impressed at the way in which all four political parties eventually came together in Ontario to support legislation to ban corporate and union donations, lower donation limits, and bring in public financing of political parties who, you know, exceed a certain vote threshold.
Right. And have to be representative. I mean, it's money for the party. So the four parties, the four main parties, starting 2017, received proportional funding based on the votes. And there was an article in the Hamilton Spectator that brought the concept of the fair debates back to my attention, something I've had a long held beef with our political challenges as a voter. And it's funny because in a roundabout way, it's really putting you on the spot. So I said I would be I wouldn't ambush you, but here's the ambush, Mike. Is so the PC, NDP, and Liberals and the Green Party of Ontario all receive public funding.
That's right.
As part of this Elections Ontario change, and it's proportional to the votes gotten in the last election. Mm-hmm. So the Green Party, somewhere north of $630,000 in 2017.
That's right, yeah, around there, yep.
A little over $4 million for the Liberals.
That's right.
A little, just I believe about $4 million or just under for the Conservatives, and somewhere around $2 million. So proportional to the vote. So first of all, that's showing, you know, you're getting a lot of votes because you're
absolutely
fourth,
getting a lot of votes.
But I mean, $630,000, $4 million. Now, those three are going to be in the, at this point, are the only three that are going to be in the televised leaders' debates that are going to be put on. So there's no way to hold you accountable for this money. So I can go after the other three leaders for what are you doing, how is your party using this to run their election campaign and so forth. You get a pass.
What's, I don't what's want the deal a pass, there? Kevin.
Yeah. Now why? Yeah.
Don't give me a pass.
No.
Don't. I want to be held accountable.
Well, and you know, as
so I want you to hold me accountable. So I think what you need to do is tell the media consortium and the other three party leaders who make these decisions behind closed doors in a very undemocratic way, that you want to hold me accountable, and as a voter citizen who actually pays taxes in this province, that you want to be able to hold me accountable. And so I'm really proud. There's an independent organization, which we obviously, you know, support work, called fairdebates.ca.
Yeah.
And it's actually started by somebody who used to work for one of the other three political parties.
Okay.
And this person has generated support from former Conservatives, Liberals, and NDP, as well as people who, you know, are not affiliated with political parties, prominent Canadians, all saying that we should have fair debates and that the Green Party should be included in the debates because we do receive public funding. We do run a full slate of candidates. And, you know, and so, you know, if people want to hold me accountable, they can go to fairdebates.ca, sign the petition.
Yep.
Thousands of people have done that, and start putting pressure on the other three leaders. Because really, if one of the other three leaders said, yeah, you know what, the Green Party should be included in this debate, Mike Treinor should be held accountable, then it would happen. But we need to go one step further than that, and we need to put this decision in the hands of Elections Ontario. It shouldn't be something that private broadcasters and political party leaders make a decision. There should be clear, transparent, democratic rules. There are 21 registered political parties in Ontario, and there should be an opportunity for all of those parties to participate in debates in some way. Now, I think it probably difficult, obviously, logistically, to have all 21 on stage at once. So maybe you have a debate with the four main parties that qualify for public funding.
That's a good start,
and,
for sure.
And then maybe have a separate debate as well that would include the other parties as well. Because otherwise, you're giving free advertising dollars, really, to the three status quo parties at the expense of all the other parties, but more importantly, at the expense of the people of Ontario. Because the people of Ontario deserve to hear what all their options are. And in our case, they deserve to have the opportunity to hold the Green Party.
The funny thing to me is that it's the intent seems to be that they want to be impartial. This is how I believe the thought starts, or it started many years ago, was, okay, we can't, you know, we're the broadcasters. We're going to get out of our own way. We're all going to be friends, CTV, CBC, Global City, whomever. And just for tonight, we're going to put the country first, or put the province first, and let the voters. So they all agree on this, basically, arrangement, right, to not air stuff against each other. They all air it, so you technically have no choice. And this, again, is going back, maybe back in the day where you did have no choice every time you turn that dial. So the concept made sense, but this started at a time where there literally was three parties. There was no other parties, or just, you know, legitimate parties to speak of. And now what you end up with, a situation as you described, is effectively private companies or corporations, private or publicly held, but I mean, corporations, for-profit corporations are arbitrarily deciding, okay, we're going to present you, pick whoever you want as long as it's one of these three. That's not far off from pick any color as long as it's red. And, you know, that, I think more people should wake up to that and maybe realize that's not cool. You probably have to say it a little nicer than I have to, but I mean, I'd call out Rogers and Bell and the other corporations to say, guys, like, you're doing it for money. That's great. You want to say it's, if you're saying it's for province, then the Green Party should be there. If you're doing it for money, look at what happened at the Republican primaries in the States, 2016. I don't know if anybody remembers that. There was 14 guys, well, 12 guys, two girls on stage, and they managed to run debates. And actually, that was some pretty darn good TV. And somehow they whittled it down to one. So from a TV entertainment perspective, which I've heard in the past, as one of the main reasons, they're like, well, it's, you know, it's going to dilute the discussion and things like that. The Green Party is running in every riding, so this isn't a discussion about, you know, you're only in two ridings, so you don't belong on the stage. That's a legitimate discussion, and you've brought up another idea, which also was done in the States, is you can have an A and a B. You can have the main leaders, and then you can have a tier, so that folks can actually realize, okay, I've heard of this. In my area, I can vote for them, or in my area, I can't. But going back to the Green Party specifically, every riding in Ontario, that's an option.
Absolutely. So here's the deal, Kevin. From my perspective, we need more democracy in Ontario, not less democracy.
Yeah.
The fact that only about 50% of the population is bothering to vote shows me that there's something broken.
Do we hit that threshold
broken.
Eventually? Will we hit, even we, hit 50?
Well, it depends. So in 2011, it was slightly under 50%, around 48.
Yeah.
And in 2014, it inched up a little bit to about 52%.
So
on average, around 50%.
Sure.
That's a problem. That shows me there's something wrong with our democracy. And so one of the ways to encourage more democracy is to show people there are more voices out there. Because I think one of the reasons 50% of the people choose not to vote is they've become disillusioned with politics. They're like, you know what, I don't like any of the three choices that, you know, that currently exist at Queen's Park. And if I don't know what my other options are, then a lot of times people don't know they have other options. And so right now we're at a critical moment where, you know, democratic legitimacy is under threat. And I think, you know, one way to combat that is to have more democracy by making sure more voices are at the table and having a democratic approach to debates. I think there are other reforms like proportional representation to make sure all votes count. Some other things like that need to happen as well. But a critically important one that could happen right now in the next 60 days is that we actually have Democratic debates in the province.
Yeah. And so I'd encourage anybody that agrees with that or that even's just looking for more information to understand. So fairdebates.ca, which again, that's an independent organization that's got a petition on the go for including all four leaders of the provincial parties, and certainly Andrea, Doug, and Catherine. Step up yourselves, make your voices heard. You guys are all out. I mean, I listen. I respect, by the way, anybody that puts themselves out to be a leader in public service. It's something 99% of people can't do. So I may disagree with passion on tons of policies, but all three of you, Andrea, Catherine, Doug, are stating you want to represent and lead the people of Ontario. You have that voice right now because you could say, hey, you know what? Mike Schreiner should be at this debate. So I'm challenging you, and I would ask you to make that happen. So we'll see. I mean,
yeah. Well, you can ambush me with a question like that anytime, Kevin.
Okay. I have another one.
Okay. Go for it.
All right. What is your policy on funding the CBC?
Well, you know what? I'll be honest with you. It is not my jurisdiction.
Oh, okay.
So I'm a provincial politician. CBC is federally funded, but I will let you know that the Green Party of Canada and my colleagues in the federal party support funding for CBC. In the 2015 federal election, the Green Party of Canada's platform called for increased funding for CBC. Provincially, I do have jurisdiction over TVO.
Right.
And I'm a big fan of TVO. I love the kids programming. All my kids grew up on TVO Kids. And I love the many of the documentaries TVO does. And I also think Steve Paikin at The Agenda does a fantastic job on raising issues of provincial significance.
Yeah.
And so I certainly support funding for TVO.
Okay. Okay. And I'm reassured that you have a concept of jurisdictions, provincial and federal. That's pretty important in our country. So that's good to hear. And one other one you mentioned briefly, Mike, and I wanted to come back to it because it's been, again, it's, I think, a key change that can be made to make our democracy better. And it's one that's been kind of close to me for some time just because of the, quite frankly, because of the way the results work, and it's the concept of first past the post, which I'm sure you live and breathe this stuff. For the audience that may not, our current democracy is built around that, or our current electoral system is built around first past the post, meaning in our riding, whatever candidates run, it could be 2, it could be 20, whoever gets the most votes wins the riding. Every other vote is essentially recorded as for somebody else, but it has no representation beyond election day. So you could, and it has happened, and people need to remember this, that one vote can make a difference. I mean, you can win by one vote next to the person behind you, and you win the part, you win the seat for the next X years. The other person goes home and, cleans up, goes and picks up a bunch of lawn signs. So that's first past the post in simple terms. Something that's has a lot of traction in other parts of the world, and we've been trying, I think, to get some better traction in Canada and in Ontario, is proportional representation. Can you maybe explain what that is, how that would work, and why we should do it?
Yeah, well, first, in proportional representation, one of the things I love about it is every vote counts, and the composition of the legislature reflects the democratic will of the people, not some falsely skewed system. And so, as an example, right now, Kathleen Wynne, received 38% of the vote in the last election, and she has 100% of the power.
Right.
And so in a sense, she's an elected dictator. And so that allows her to do things like privatize Hydro One, which, 80 to 90%, depending on which poll you looked at, people in Ontario opposed. And so government can make disastrous decisions like privatizing Hydro One under a first-past-the-post system because they have 100% of the power, 38% of the vote. Under proportional representation, if you get 38% of the vote, you have 38% of the seats. If you get 15% of the vote, you have 15% of the seats.
Mm-hmm.
20%, whatever. And so that then reflects the democratic will of the people. But just as importantly, it means that every vote counts. So imagine a conservative voter in, let's say, downtown Toronto in a riding that's gone liberal for, you know, 40, 50 years. What's your incentive to go out and vote? Because you feel like your vote doesn't count because your riding always goes liberal.
Right.
Or if you're a liberal voter in a rural riding that's gone conservative since, you know, the time of Confederation, you're thinking, well, why bother voting? Because my vote never counts. I'm never represented. It, you know, the vote always goes to this particular one party. And so one of the reasons voter turnout is declining so dramatically is that people don't feel like their vote counts.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It doesn't count under the current first past the post system.
Right.
And
it,
so when
it counts till the votes are counted, yeah. Right? So everybody should go out and vote.
Yeah.
But and to
so,
your point.
So then yeah. We have implications of that. So winner take all politics leads or votes leads to winner take all politics.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
So then you have political parties driving wedge issues and trying to talk more about what separates us and divides us than actually what unites us and about policies that'll put people first.
Right.
You have less diversity. So if you look at countries with proportional representation, they have more women involved in elected office,
mm-hmm.
more visible minorities involved in elected office. We start removing some of those systemic barriers and systemic forms of discrimination that keep people out of politics and out of elected office. Those barriers start to be removed. You have a more civil discourse.
Mm-hmm.
And let me give you a concrete example of that, what's happening
sure.
in Ontario right now. So right now, the minimum wage increase is a very controversial issue. And you have, you know, the new leader of the Conservative Party basically saying, you know what, workers do not deserve a fair living wage.
Mm.
And, you know, so you could still work full time and live in poverty. You have the premier pitting workers against local family-owned business owners.
Right.
Saying,
yeah.
you know what, we're going to raise the minimum wage. We don't care what effect it has on your business. Both of those parties are creating a wedge issue out of people's
mm-hmm.
lives, and they want to try to drive votes with those wedge issues. And that's what happens in winner-take-all politics.
Mm-hmm.
The Green Party is saying, hey, let's have a different approach. We support raising the minimum wage. We support a living wage for workers.
Yeah.
We also support lowering payroll taxes on small businesses
mm-hmm.
so they can afford to hire more people at a higher wage. It's a win-win for both, but we don't have a wedge issue anymore. And it's those kinds of collaborative decisions that put people first that are about how do we create win-win situations that benefit Ontario that get lost in this winner-take-all politics. And so when I talk about doing politics differently, it's issues like supporting, you know, a higher minimum wage and fair taxes for local family-run businesses. That's the kind of things I'm talking about,
mm-hmm.
about ways we could do politics differently. If we had something like proportional representation, there would be more incentives for parties to put forward ideas that are win-win policies instead of wedge issue policies.
Absolutely, and it's you know, that's a great way to drive the example home, because that, you know, I was surprised how controversial that was when they did it. First of all, it wasn't like they woke up one morning and just tweeted, hey, here's what we're doing, and then everybody is like, what's Catherine talking about? This was discussed. I don't know to what degree it was debated and agreed upon in Parliament. I
mm-hmm.
I will confess to not watching the parliamentary channel very often, but I do know that it was announced.
Yeah.
People knew this was coming. It came, and then all of a sudden, you know, the news story, that which is unfortunate because it's what people walk away from, is if
right.
if I step back and say, okay, what's my 10-second recollection of this? Somehow the government's trying to screw local business, Tim Hortons sucks, and a bunch of people can't make a living wage.
You've described exactly the story most people are
receiving.
Yeah,
which is inaccurate. You know, or it's not the whole picture,
yeah.
right?
So when I knock on doors, when I go talk to local business owners, and I put forward the Green Party solution to both raise the minimum wage so people who work full-time don't live in poverty,
yeah.
and lower payroll taxes on small businesses so they can afford to hire more people at a higher wage, people say to me, it's like, why isn't this happening at Queen's Park?
Right.
And so part of it is that the big parties, the establishment parties, they want wedge issues because they want to be able to say, vote for us, you know, if you're in this group, or vote for us if you're in this group,
mm-hmm.
rather than coming up with solutions that actually bring people together. And some of that, not all of it, but some of that is driven by our current electoral system, first past the post, which creates winner take all
mm-hmm.
political motives.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And, you've also got the, the concept of binary choice, which is what you're alluding to, right? And it does seem, unfortunately, because, you know, I'm a bit of a nerd, and the concept of binary, I think, is a positive one.
Yeah.
Right? But it's been used, the words become pejorative, but it's used a lot in politics of binary choice. You know, pick me or pick her or him. And then it forces people into this very simplistic model of, okay, well, yep, there's one thing I don't like. I can't stand this one thing. So therefore, I just have no choice. It's a cop-out for people, for voters sometimes, to avoid responsibility for the decision because they put it into that.
Right.
And I mean, that's a great example, the one you brought up. And I just want to go back to it a bit around, because economics is a key piece for everybody's life. A lot of things are important, but at the end of the day, people that, you know, small businesses, you ran businesses. I ran and owned a business for many years, and of course it matters, you know, and, you know, profit for a company, is, especially small businesses, which is the bulk of our economy, is not some giant pile of cash that's just being piled up. That's the money that feeds that family. Yeah. It's also the money that helps employ other people and drive the economy and so on and so forth. So it's not an either or of I must support, you know, a minimum wage increase, or I must support small businesses. No, we must, out of obligation, I think, support both, because they're both people of Ontario, right?
Absolutely. And both contribute to our local economies, the prosperity of our local communities. Yeah. It's how we raise the revenues we want to build livable communities that connect people. You know, another example of a kind of a wedge issue is now, unfortunately, climate change. I mean, we are experiencing the climate crisis right now. We're experiencing, you know, the financial losses associated with it. Last year alone, $4.9 billion in insurable losses due to extreme weather events caused by climate change.
That's in Canada alone.
And, according to the Insurance Bureau of Canada.
Okay.
And then also, I mean, geez, you turn on your TV and watch the evening news and you see floods and hurricanes and ice storms. And so it's really affecting people's lives and communities. And, you know, we sort of have one establishment party that's saying, we don't have to do anything about climate change with the new leader the Conservatives have elected.
So their position is literally, don't worry about it, it's not happening?
Well, that appears to me. Yeah. I mean, you know, the previous Conservative leader said, you know, we'll support a price on carbon.
That's right.
Pollution. Okay. We'll put a price on pollution. And so then the debate became a disagreement over how to price pollution.
Right.
So now you have one party saying, do nothing. You have another party saying, let's do, and the Liberals saying, let's do something. But then they allow the 150 largest polluters in Ontario a free pass.
Mm.
And so again, but climate change now has become a wedge issue. And the Green Party is saying, you know what? Let's not make this a wedge issue. We can actually develop solutions that are good for our economy by embracing the clean economy, embracing the jobs that come from the clean economy. As an example, right now, 274,000 Canadians work in the clean energy sector, earning an average salary of $92,000. So if you want to talk about good, solid, well-paying middle-class jobs, that's where it comes from. So this whole debate around, you know, economy versus the environment, jobs versus the environment, no action on climate versus action on climate is such an outdated debate. We can take action on climate change that will actually create more jobs and build more economic prosperity for our communities if we embrace the clean economy, clean technology, clean innovation, advanced manufacturing, bioproducts, etc. And there's examples of that starting to happen all over Ontario. So we don't have to make these false choices.
Thank you. It's almost as if you were reading ahead for me on my notes, because I had written down a reminder for myself to talk about some myths. In fact, I called it myth busting. This dichotomy that people seem to want to make. I like your way of putting it as a wedge issue, because that's what it is either you save the planet, either you want to be environmentally friendly, but that's going to cost money. That's somehow that equation was made and perhaps was true at some point in the distant past. But even I can share a real life example of my own in a business setting where this is going back a few years too, but we had made the decision to change our fleet of vehicles to hybrid cars in mm-hmm. the, you know, this was late 2000, well, like, yeah, mid 2006, 2008, I don't remember exactly. So 10 plus years ago anyways. And I did it out of a, to be honest, the first reason is I just thought it was the coolest thing in the world that you could drive in a car powered by electricity. The mm-hmm. first time I sat in one, I go, this is amazing. So that was my selfish reason for doing it. It turned out that it was great for the environment, which was very important to me.
Mm-hmm.
And the third thing, so I had already made my decision, but the third thing that was most interesting is when I did the math, I was making more money. I was saving costs
absolutely.
Around operation, maintenance, and that did not even include any environmental cost, which at that right. point, from a business perspective, I guess I got a pass on, because it right. didn't matter as a business owner. If I was driving and our job was to, you know, had required vehicles on the road as part mm-hmm. of our delivery of our service. So it had to be done. It was a matter of how we're going to do it. Whether I put out 10 times the emissions right. than the next guy, same price, right?
Right,
So all that aside, which isn't an aside, I'm just saying it just wasn't counted then. But economically, it was a better decision for the bottom line for me. And
absolutely.
I said, look, it's my money.
I'm saving money.
And I'm showing it to you. So it works. And it didn't require some complicated thing. And this wasn't based on all kinds of, you know, strange math. It was pure business economics. And it cost me less money to operate that way than it did with pure gas cars. And that's, like I said, that's a simple one. There's probably so many more.
There are many examples like that. I'll give you a quick one.
Sure.
And just mostly because you raise a really important issue is, you know, one of the best ways to do something good for the environment is to actually save energy, which helps you save money.
Yeah.
And so it's good for your pocketbook. So, you know, if you retrofit your home to make it more energy efficient, you're going to save money by saving energy. As a small business owner, if I buy more energy efficient equipment, I'm going to save money by saving energy. Oh, and by the way, I'm going to reduce my impact on the planet. The choosing an electric vehicle over a gas guzzler is going to help you save money by saving energy on your fuel costs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I do short distance traveling, I mostly cycle or walk if I
right.
can.
Okay.
And when I need to drive a car, usually it's when I have to go longer distances. So I still have a hybrid. I have a Prius, which isn't even, you know, compared to a fully electric vehicle is not even all that environmentally responsible anymore.
It's
from that perspective. But I still tell people, when I fill my Prius up and I spend $40 and I can go, you know, 900 kilometers on that. And, you know, I talk to somebody else and there's, you know, filling up a gas guzzler, $80-$90, and, you know, they're going to travel a half or even less of the distance. You know, that is more money in my pocket. So doing the thing that's good for the environment is good for my pocketbook. And that's something that sometimes gets forgotten when people start looking at fancy new technology, even, you know, like the solar panels here, the geothermal there, wind turbines, and all those things are great. But sometimes lost in that conversation is the fact that if you actually, you know, become more energy efficient, you reduce your consumption, you're saving money and saving the planet at the same time.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, that's something that I think people can relate to a lot easier. And again, the opportunity, I think, just for folks like yourself to be able to get that message out there, again, for voters to make up their mind. They may say, you know what, I want to spend more money driving a gas guzzler. Hey, guess what? It's a democracy. Go for it. But be informed.
Exactly.
Right? And that's, you know, which, for instance, having all four parties at the debates. I didn't check my Twitter, but I don't know. I don't think Doug, Andrea, or Catherine have DM'd me to let me know that they're supporting this. So
what's your Twitter handle?
It's mine is at my audio face. So at my audio face would be one of the ways to for Doug, Catherine, or Andrea to tell me that you're going to support having the Green Party at the debates. And again, it's a no lose proposition, right? Because it almost becomes like, what are you guys afraid of? Really?
Yeah, absolutely.
You're like, is it, you know, I know, well, I do know what they're afraid of. I mean, quite frankly, it's very much the status quo always wants to keep the status quo. I can guarantee you that if I was, you know, if the only way I would not get my job is to allow other people to have a chance at getting it, but if I didn't have to do that, I didn't. Well, it you know, it explains itself.
Exactly.
Well, that's one less person to worry about. You know, you could make all kinds of funny questions and say, well, I guess Catherine must sort of prefer Doug and Andrea to Mike because she's debating them on TV, so she's giving them some free press too, but somehow not wanting to do it for you. I don't know. It's things we can ask her if she comes on.
So it will show you how tough it is to change the status quo. It is never easy to change the establishment. And so I know in this election, all the polling data, and I is saying this, I can tell you when I'm knocking on people's doors or visiting people in cafes or whatever, everywhere I go, people are saying they want change.
Yeah. Like,
this is a change election. But the question is are you really going to get change replacing one establishment party with another establishment party, all three trying to protect the status quo? And so my message to voters is, if you really want change, if you really think the status quo at Queen's Park is broken, if you're tired of the three establishment parties, the only way to change things is to vote for a new party with a new vision and a new way of doing politics, and that's the Green Party of Ontario. And elected Greens across the world and across the country are delivering on that promise. So we see it in Iceland now with their first Green Prime Minister. We see it in the most conservative province in Germany, the heart of the German auto sector, very similar to Ontario, now has a German premier. Three elected Green MLAs in British Columbia holding the balance of power. You know, the New Brunswick Green leader elected. The PEIs just doubled their caucus. The Green leader now is polling number one. And the reason that change is happening across Canada and around the world is that people are seeing when they elect Greens that, yes, this is a party that says they're going to do politics differently and actually delivers on doing it differently and is bringing the kinds of change and challenges to the status quo that people really want. Because I think most people are looking at things going like, you know what? I'm looking at myself and I'm thinking the status quo just isn't working for me. Maybe it's time to try something different. And the only way to do that is to actually elect a party that isn't one of the three establishment parties.
It makes perfect sense. Now you're running, Mike, not only, so you're obviously the leader of the party for the province of Ontario, you're running as a candidate in Guelph.
Yeah, I want to be a strong voice for Guelph. I mean, Guelph has been a community that's been a leader in many of the things I care deeply about. So Guelph's a leader in a number of environmental initiatives, everything from waste reduction to water conservation to community energy development, a leader in small businesses, more small businesses per capita than any community in Canada.
Really?
Very, very strong small business community. I mean, I know people know Linamar and some of the larger corporations in Guelph, but there's a very strong small business community in Guelph, a very strong sense of entrepreneurship. And Guelph's also just a deeply caring community, the kind of community that, you know, leads in number of volunteers, leads in charitable donations and things like that. And so a place that, you know, embraces innovation and technology and sort of clean solutions to things, a caring community, a place that, you know, people want to take care of each other and the planet, and a place that really wants to invest in the community, whether it's, you know, through the nonprofit sector or through the small business community, is the kind of place where Greens really do well because it reflects the values of the Green Party.
Right. And to come back to something you started the mentioning at the beginning of the show, which is, I think, very key for those that might not know the whole platform, and it's something, you know, that I discovered for myself over the years, as you mentioned, you know, we're not here to name birth years or ages or anything like that, other than when I was able to vote as a 18-year-old, there was 2.5 choices. I mean, for all practical purposes, for, you know, Confederation back when I was a kid, and back, not that I wasn't born in 1867, I'm just, you know, there was two parties. There was the Liberals and the Conservatives, and then the NDP would pop up and be sort of an outlier, and then some, you know, with an exception in Ontario. That was my lifetime of politics up until 15, 20 years ago, where all of a sudden it became a little more open. And the first, you know, the common thing, again, from a business background, so my social network tended to be business folks. The common thing I'd hear is, you know, well, I can't vote Green because it doesn't make sense for the economy. And one thing that I think you brought up, and I want to get you to maybe elaborate on, is when I looked at it, what I saw is, okay, there are some parts of what I would call traditional conservative policy, and by conservative, I'm talking about the party, in terms of economic responsibility in terms of free enterprise and supporting local business and allowing people to make decisions to that will allow them to thrive as individuals and small businesses. And then there was some progressive things that I liked about other parties in terms of, you know, human rights and respect of people and social justice. And, you know, at the end of the day, all this stuff, you can believe in climate change or not believe in it and think it's a hoax that came from China or whatever. But we have one planet, it's the one we live on, and I think we all agree that it should be taken care of and sustained, if for no other reason than the selfish reason of if it goes south, I don't know where you're going to run to, but this is it. So I guess maybe you can more eloquently put together how somebody that has traditionally been aligned themselves with, oh, I vote this way, I vote that way, how they can maybe see themselves to grab, well, you know what, I agree with this and I agree with that, and hey, there's the Green Party's policy.
Well, I really encourage people to go to gpo.ca/vision.
Okay.
And look at our vision book that we released a few weeks ago. And it's really showing people how we will fight for jobs, people, and planet.
Okay.
And for me, it's, you know, how we can create good, well-paying jobs mm-hmm. that put people and planet first. And I think regardless of your political background or you know, ideology, I think those are values that most Canadians, Ontarians support.
Mm-hmm.
And so we just want to be really honest with people about what the challenges are and what our solutions or the solutions we're proposing to deal with those challenges. And I'll be frank with you, you know, these aren't solutions that, you know, we developed ourselves. These are solutions that are happening in communities across Ontario
mm-hmm.
based on my experience and meeting with hundreds of people across the province. And so for us, we call it people-powered change. It's showing how people are creating jobs that put people and planet first, that are showing how we can build a prosperous economy with meaningful, well-paying work for people, that generates the prosperity we need to invest in people
mm-hmm.
to help alleviate poverty and have social justice, to invest in better health care and education and child care and social service, and being honest with people about how we're going to pay for it, and that can also protect the places we love in Ontario. I mean, we're just such blessed with such a beautiful province. Why wouldn't we take care of it? It's sort of like if you have a nice house, you know, don't you want to like fix it up, repair it, make sure the roof doesn't get damaged or
sure,
the
yeah.
floor doesn't get all damaged or whatever. So why would we allow that to happen to our larger home, which is this planet?
Yeah.
And so protecting water, protecting farmland, protecting the green space that, you know, people love to go hiking in and walking in and canoeing and cycling and, you know, or go for a Sunday afternoon drive and
mm-hmm.
and just enjoy. Why wouldn't we want to protect that? And then finally making decisions that, you know, benefit ourselves today, but also benefit our children and grandchildren in the next seven generations. And for me, an example of that is, you know, our great grandparents built Niagara Falls,
mm-hmm.
the electricity generating station, and it cost a lot of money to do that. And people were taxed to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But building that public infrastructure created the power that powered Ontario's manufacturing sector throughout the 20th century and helped Ontario to be such a prosperous place to live and a good place to live with good middle-class jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's our job now, our generation's job, to make the kind of investments today and be honest with people about how we're actually going to pay for them that's going to set our children and grandchildren in the next seven generations up to be successful. And so part of that is leaping forward now, leaping
yeah.
into the future now to support the clean economy and those clean economy 21st century jobs that also happen to protect the people and places we love here, to make sure that we, you know, have a habitable planet and livable communities for our kids in the next seven generations. And I think that's such a basic responsibility for any government to deliver.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it again drives home the point that sometimes get lost is all politicians, party leaders, but all elected officials that will sit in the legislature, I think it gets forgotten. They're stewards of our government, which is stewards of our land and a lot of stuff to do with our lives on our behalf, on behalf of all the citizens of the province. And that's a big responsibility. And that's one that you know, does again bring back the idea that, yeah, it's pretty easy to get disillusioned and cynical and say, well, I'm not going to vote. They're all the same. First of all, if you pay a little bit of attention, they're not all the same. There's a clear difference. But beyond that, it's a responsibility that we have to each other, not just to myself, to say, well, I'm not going to vote, and therefore, you know, I'm not going to complain about it. But I'm letting my fellow citizens down by not fully participating as a voter as yeah. well. And you know, we reap what we sow. And if we go and put all these, you know, we let things happen and then blame, you know, everybody that blames the government, so to speak. And sure, they may not have thought what was going to happen is happening. But to your point, if 52% of the eligible voters voted and, you know, the Liberal government got in, well, those other 48%, that's a pretty big chunk of people. Yeah. They could have voted and they could have made a difference to whatever it is they're complaining about today.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
So,
well, and I think, you know, a point you made that is important to me is our shared responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that really angers me about politics today is, you know, a lot of the establishment politicians just reduce people to taxpayers.
Mm.
It's like taxpayers, taxpayers, taxpayers. And yeah, we all pay taxes, but we're mm-hmm. more than taxpayers.
Yeah, yeah.
And frankly, we're more than voters, because oftentimes politicians try to figure out how to harvest votes. Mm. We're more than voters. Mm-hmm. We're citizens. We're right. people. And with citizens mm-hmm. come certain rights, like the right to vote, but it also has certain responsibilities. And so I like the way you talked about our shared responsibility, because that's an important point of being a good citizen and being a good member of our community. And I think, you know, regardless of, you know, where you sit on the political spectrum, I think people do care deeply about their community, their family, their neighborhood. And so, you know, having politicians and having government policies that reflect that value of caring for people
mm-hmm.
and caring for the places that support people is so critically important.
Absolutely. And it's, again, what I hear listening to a lot of that is it's not an either or, it's an and, as far as,
absolutely,
you know, you can be responsible and professional and focused and logical in your role as a politician or as an elected representative. That doesn't mean that you're leaving your compassion and your caring and your empathy at the door, which I think sometimes they go, well, you know, I don't want people all fuzzy getting all their feelings up in there in Queen's Park. And it's like, well, actually they do. They just have feelings of anger and jealousy and, you know, sticking it to the other guy, perhaps emotions. But I think most people generally are compassionate. Most people are caring, kind. That's my sincere belief. Certainly when they choose to be, right? I mean, if you talk to the vast majority of people, if not all people, they would share that absolutely I have, you know, compassion and love and so forth for my spouse, my child,
mm-hmm.
my family. Oh, my cousin Vinny, nah, maybe not so much. But, you know, but then all of a sudden there's this drop off where it's like, that person there is now removed a little bit from me and all that's gone. And they're now viewing it, like you said, that's a taxpayer. Or worse, that person doesn't pay taxes. Therefore, X, Y, Z should happen or shouldn't happen. And you go, but that's not you. You're a kind, compassionate person. And now you're talking about whole swaths of the population, you know, that are just being, well, they're a cost. We're going to do this about it. And I'm going to segue that slightly into an area of provincial responsibility, the healthcare system. That's yes. That's a big one. It's always a big one because it's, quite frankly, a huge cost. It's, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's the single, aside it's from finance,
largest.
I think.
No, it's the largest. So it's about 42% of Ontario's budget.
So if the government had only one thing to do, if we said you better stop everything else but do one, it's going to be public health, which is, you know, hospitals and our
right.
OHIP and so on and so forth. And you know, I'll state as again, my personal opinion, my personal experiences, you know, darn, it's awesome in so many ways. There are some tremendous issues. I've run into some personally that quite frankly, I'm glad that I was able to not be as impacted.
Mm-hmm.
But it scared me in terms of sometimes waiting 12 months between the time you identify a medical requirement and the ability to have something done about it. I would say that not everybody has 12 months to wait, and they're not there when the help comes. That's an issue. you know, and you hear stories from other jurisdictions. I think Quebec is in a horrible, horrible state. And I, just to bear with me one sec, I'll leave the province. Quebec has some real challenges around, it's starting to show up in their nursing. The nursing community is essentially burning out, and it's creating a bit of a, you know, a spillover effect, because it's starting to more and more things are coming out, and there's waits and whatnot. And we have a lot of those similar issues here. I haven't heard them quite so drastically, but back to Ontario, we have we're blessed, I think, to have a fantastic system with just great people in it. Costs a lot of money, and it's far from perfect. So, you know, maybe talk to us a little bit in particular around the wait for care, and certainly a big one that is big locally here in southwestern Ontario, Cambridge, Kitchener, Waterloo, Guelph. Opioids keeps coming up, right? That's maybe you can share a little bit there.
Sure. Yeah, so it's a multi-part
question. I know, that was a lot.
I'll give you a multi-part answer.
You have 10 seconds, sir.
Yeah, there you go. So hopefully I get a little bit longer than that. But first of all, I would say, you know, I must say, just to give a shout out to nurses in particular.
Absolutely.
That the stress nurses are under is high in Ontario as well. So it's not just a Quebec issue. Mm. And if you talk to nurses, they are under a tremendous amount of stress because they're doing a ton of work with limited resources.
And they're front line, right?
Front line. So one of the things that really disturbs me about this whole wedge issue politics is we sort of have the two big establishment parties, the Liberals and Conservatives, saying, you know, one saying, hey, you know, cut, 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 and the other saying, spend, spend, spend.
Mm.
And yes, our healthcare system needs more investments, but those investments need to be done smartly.
Yeah.
And I think we need to reform our healthcare system.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the big reforms is to actually start investing more in preventing illness and promoting health in the first place, instead of just treating sickness, which is important. Like, we need more resources going to hospitals and acute care and traditional medicine, no doubt about it. But we also, I think, need to start investing more in primary care, community health care, nurse practitioner-led clinics, more holistic practitioners on the ground in communities, supporting a wide range of services for people, more investment in long-term care, home care, assisted support for seniors, because we want to try to prevent people from ending up in hospital in the first place.
Right.
And so it is higher quality care and lower cost care to care for people in community and in their home rather than in hospital. So that investment in reforming our system to put more in frontline community care to prevent illness is critically important. And then related to that is how we address mental health and addictions. So we have to get away, I think, as a society from particularly creating addictions, treating it as a criminal justice issue, and start treating it as a healthcare issue. Because as the police chief in Guelph says, and I'm proud to be from Guelph, and you have a police chief who says this, that we cannot arrest our way out of the mental health and addictions, particularly addictions crisis we're facing.
Yeah.
And so if we provide people with the healthcare services they need, particularly the mental health care services they need. So I think mental health care should be a part of OHIP. The fact that 12,000 kids are on a waiting list to access mental health services, the fact that many adults are on waiting lists, the fact that a lot of people facing addictions issues can't get access to the treatment and care they deserve oftentimes means they end up in a merge, which is not the appropriate place to receive the care they need and cost the system lots of money. Oftentimes they end up in the criminal justice system using up huge amounts of resources in our police services that could be better utilized somewhere else.
Absolutely,
if we just provided people with the care they need. And so one of that is investing more in mental health care and addictions, providing the supports people need, but also looking at things like taking a housing first strategy to support people with mental health and addictions. There's numerous research showing that if you provide people with stable housing, then you can start providing other forms of care.
Right.
Actually starting to address poverty in this province. You know, Ontario's never recovered from the 22% social assistance rate cut that the Harris government delivered in the mid-90s. The Liberals have never made that cut up. And so you have so many people now just living in crushing poverty that then leads to other health issues that actually cost our society a lot of money. So if we would invest in caring for people and caring for people in our communities and in livable communities, that would go a long way towards reforming our healthcare system so we could provide better care at more efficiently and at lower cost.
Right. And we're butting up right against the end of the hour already. Prevention instead of, and now the other word's escaping me. I was going to be all eloquent for you. But it's just common sense is what I'm
well,
hearing out of your mouth.
Well, it seems like it, but it's hard for governments because it's hard to measure.
Maybe.
It's hard to measure the savings
but the concept,
from it.
I
but
think
it makes so much sense. Other countries spend about 9-10% of their healthcare budget on preventing illness, promoting health. Ontario only spends about 1%. Right. So even if we just shifted those percentages a bit, I would think we'd go a long way towards making sure people have healthier lives.
And it's to me it's a bit of a small. I don't think it's a big change. It's a mindset change to say, you know what, I'm not going to buy a brand new car, drive it like a maniac for 7 years, and every time it just blows up, I'm just going to, you know, have all these resources just jump on me and give me a new car or do an emergency on the road. No, you take care of it. You
exactly.
do preventative things. You go, okay, it's been this long. Let me do this. Let me extend the life. So bringing that concept to our healthcare to say, of course, we want to treat emergencies and continue to take care of all the things that need to be taken care of. But it's okay to layer on top of that some preventative, some lifestyle enhancements and things like that. So just very quickly, already cutting in a little bit, DJ Denim, you will accept my apologies for cutting into a bit of your precious time. I just want to get in a couple dates here. April 11th, you are in a debate.
Yes, there will be a debate. Operation Black Votes hosting a debate next week. I'm very excited. The Premier NDP leader, Andrew Horvath, and I will be in the debate. Hopefully the Conservative leader will join us as well.
I understand he's not on the list. Is he booked on April 11th or does he not do debates?
What I've heard on social media is that he has another engagement.
Oh dear. Yeah.
Which is too bad.
Labels maybe. I don't know. We shouldn't label people.
No.
Okay. But regardless, the important thing is, that's April 11th. So for folks that want details to attend this, where do we send them for info?
If you Google Operation Black Vote, you'll certainly get details. We'll also have details on our website, gpo.ca, as well.
Okay. And then April 21st in Guelph, you're hosting the one and only David Suzuki, as well as the federal leader, Elizabeth May.
We're excited. Hanlon Convention Center.
Hanlon Convention
Center.
It'll
be an Earth Day rally. We're really excited about it. Community's welcome to come out. 1 o'clock Saturday afternoon, David Suzuki, Elizabeth May, Mike Schreiner will have some great music and great community as well.
Wonderful. Mike Schreiner, thank you very much. Leader of the Green Party of Ontario, gpo.ca to read up on the platform, fairdebates.ca, which is independent of the Green Party, but is where you want to go to sign a petition so that we can hold Mike accountable, as well as the other three leaders who, for some reason, are not supporting, debating, the Green Party in the televised debate. So we'll see if that changes. This has been Kevin in studio on CKMS 102.7.